drummer, but they were fucking awesome. And I definitely didn't remember ever having heard their name before.
Rob Sheffield. 6 months later, it was completely different. I think they did 4 nights at Bowery, and they were all sold out. I remember seeing Bette Midler there, and I was like, oh, this is beautiful. It wasn't, oh, now this is over. It was the opposite of over. The fantasy we always had about all the bands that we always liked in the 90s was, man, if they could actually play their music in front of people and people heard it, they would like it, whether it was true or not. It was happening with the Strokes and the White Stripes. And you could tell because Bette Midler was showing up to see the White Stripes at Bowery. It was like, wow, this is crossing boundaries.
Jenny Eliscu. Radio City, I mean, obviously is a venue artists recognize. It's like playing the Greek Theater. You're like, wow, he would have dreamed of it. And it feels like a real moment in your career. And even though both bands were big enough to play it on their own, it was like, ooh, together? Wow, now that's cool. It felt like undeniably a hot ticket.
Mark Ronson. That show was the first time I saw Jack White play guitar live. I was completely blown away.
Jenny Eliscu. For one of those shows, Rolling Stone hosted a party afterward at Lit, the darkest lit place on Earth.
Austin Skaggs. That was really the big night. I just met all those guys, and I told Ryan Gentles about one of those illegal poker places, and he's like, oh yeah, we've got to go to that. So I took him, and then all of a sudden, Julian was coming with us. I was starstruck. I thought Julian was just untouchable. He was the most elusive one, the most drunk one, the most... He was scary. A very intimidating kind of presence. But then we all started playing poker. Ryan started hosting poker tournaments in his house. Harmar Superstar. They were totally stone-faced poker guys. I don't know who the best player is. You could ask Ryan. He'll say it's him. Ryan Gentles. Sean Lennon had a poker game at his apartment and taught me how to play, and I was hooked. I wanted to do it more regularly, and Julian got way into it and convinced me to do this, and Austin Skaggs. So I started hosting. It was me, Julian, Albert, Fab, Austin, Sean Lennon. It turned into a thing where I did it every week with a bunch of different players. Caleb Followill. I always beat those guys at poker. The first time I went to Ryan's, I was so green, and it was so infuriating to them because I would lay down my cards and be like, is that good? And they were like, you motherfucker. Just one winning hand after another. Austin Skaggs. You were right in the center of the vortex, in the middle of your everyday life.
Jenny Eliscu. That party after the Radio City show was good. I don't remember if Jack came, actually, now, but I'm pretty sure. But the Strokes all came. It was like, if I have to go to a Strokes after party, it was the party that you would actually want to go to. You'd want it to be at Lit. You'd want Justine to DJ. But there were elements that made it feel like part of the new era of the new awkward era of everyone wants to meet these guys.
Ryan Adams. It was the first time I saw the competition. The Strokes invited the White Stripes to their biggest New York show, but the White Stripes were already on their own path to get big. I remember there being a moment of me going, how's this going to play? How's this going to feel later to the Strokes? Everybody talked about that show being a big deal, but I think because the White Stripes were on that bill, it lessened the feel of the Strokes going, we did it! We conquered New York City for New York City rock again. Because as everyone knows and says, it was a no man's land before that. But there was talk that night. Or at least there were subtle undertones, spoken or unspoken or both, of, was it a bad idea to have the White Stripes be there? Mark Spitz. I don't know. It wasn't the Strokes versus the White Stripes in a Beatles versus Stones kind of way. Or a Blur versus Oasis kind of way. Really early on, even, there was a show at the Bowery Ballroom, and I can't remember who was playing it. It might have even been the White Stripes, or maybe it was Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And I saw Julian and Jack together, and they were chatty, and maybe had their arms around each other. And I felt like, well, they get it. You know? It wasn't like them versus the White Stripes. It was all of us versus Coldplay and Limp Bizkit, and George Bush and Al-Qaeda, you know? It was the cool kids fighting back. Stephen Trachtenbreit. Jack is super creative, super independent-minded. And Julian has that same thing. He has a lot of ideas. I'm not necessarily a big fan of Jack, but I like the fact that he's always pushing something. And I feel like Jules is trying to do that. He's trying something. He has a vision. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You have to put yourself out there. You have to do it. Jules has that capability. But he stopped himself. And I feel like Jack didn't stop himself. And so he succeeded. He won, out of the two. The Strokes opened up the door for all of these bands, and the White Stripes just went, thank you very much, and passed right through. Mark Ronson. What you have to remember is that at that time, there were no great rock records that you could play in a hip-hop set. There were no quote-unquote black rock records. There hadn't been in ages. The Strokes were cool, and people liked them because they had the kind of jump-up rhythm. But they were hard ones to play on a dance floor. Then Seven Nation Army came. I remember being at Sound Factory, a hip-hop party, and Kid Capri was DJing that night. Kid Capri is a pillar of old-school New York hip-hop, and seeing him throw on that song in the middle of his set, I was like, wow, this shit's finally come around. Jack came and played guitar on a song on my first album, but then he heard the record when it was finished, and he didn't like the rap that Freeway had done on the track, so he made me take him off the song. I wrote him a letter. I was like, listen, I know you don't like this rap. You might not get what he's talking about, but you mean a lot to people in rap, and I wish you could see what it's like when you play Seven Nation Army to a club of 700 young black kids at 2 in the morning. Your music means something to these people. Ryan Gentles. For the VMAs that year, right after the Radio City shows, MTV wanted to have a battle of the garage bands between the Strokes, the Vines, and the Hives. They wanted the Strokes to play on the main stage. Julian was like, no, I'll go play on the Video Music Awards, but I just want to play my song and we're done. That's cool. I won't do this weird thing where I play a 30-second snippet and then the Vines play theirs. We're not competitors. I like those bands, but some of the songs I don't like, and I don't want to make people think we're part of that scene. That's Julian. Everyone's like, he's crazy. You have to make him do this. And I say, all right, I'm going to bring him to lunch and we'll try to talk him into it. Fine, we'll show him. Then we get to lunch and he's like, no. And eventually they're like, okay. Albert Hammond Jr. When MTV wanted us to do the VMAs, we said, okay, we'll play the VMAs. It sounds awesome. We saw it when we were kids. When it was, oh, you want us to do it as a medley with the Vines and the Hives? No. I didn't want to be defined by those other bands, which is nothing to say against those bands. It's just a decision. It's so early on in your game. You're trying to push really hard to be perceived bigger than you are. So you can push forward. It's a catch-22. You learn. Patrick Matthews. Before we played the VMAs, we first came to New York in early 2002. We played Mercury Lounge, and later CBGB. The Strokes were there. I remember one of them had a joint and offered it to me, and I just didn't like joints, so I didn't take it. Another time, at a music festival in Scotland, I was standing in the backstage area, and Albert walked past and put his hand out to shake, and I dropped my cigarette like a hopeless rube. They were really intimidating. Harmar Superstar. I took Kelly Osbourne to the VMAs that year, when White Stripes won everything. The Strokes were there, and then afterward they played that Milk Studios party with Mos Def's band. Jim Merlis. Cornerstone put this party together with Levi's. The idea was to be a sort of anti-VMA party. Mos Def and the Strokes played. Rufus Wainwright came and Dr. Dre came, and it was insane. I remember seeing Dr. Dre watching the Strokes and digging it big time.
Alex Wagner. That was a legendary party. Jenny Eliscu. That was a fucking lame party. You could tell what a clusterfuck it was from down the block. There was some shitty clipboard door person who couldn't get me in. We ended up getting in anyway, only to have it be too dark, too impossible to get a drink or use the bathroom. Just this cluster of gross chaos and people trying to make the scene. I mean, it was gross. It was ethically gross, you know what I mean? It was the kind of thing where people were gonna piss in the trash can. And as someone who'd seen the Strokes play to like 15 people at some club in Philly, it was like, fuck everyone. It definitely felt like, oh no, those of us who loved them up until this point are going to leave them now to a bigger world. It's a classic thing where if you got in on the ground floor, it's because you don't want to be a part of that world. And then you're happy for them to get there because you want your friends and the things that you love to do well. But I felt sad, like, that's it. I'm not going to see those guys as much anymore, you know?
Jim Merlis. We as a company, Big Hassle, got paid, I think, $20,000 to get press to it. I was like, really? You want anything else? That's all they wanted.
Jenny Eliscu. I wonder how those guys felt about that party. They probably were not really capable of taking it in at the time because they were having so many experiences like that. I wonder if what we know now as like a shitty corporate hipster party was just in its nascence then. I wonder if the Strokes were accidentally part of the foundation of that entire weird zone. They were so cool, so many people wanted to glom onto them. That helped give rise to a bullshit aesthetic-based version of something that, to a lot of us, was genuinely meaningful.
Jack White. We all had a lot of opinions and worries about what was happening and what was the right next thing to try. It was powerfully exciting and energetic. People really loved music all around us, and you could really tell. You can't manufacture that kind of energy in the world of the arts. It has to be decided by the mob and God herself. Chapter 48. I like this internet thing. John Heilman. The obvious thing to say is that the same overriding forces of technology that caused the commercial, economic, and cultural fallout that changed the music industry and changed music are also the forces that changed the industry that covered the music industry and music. That's all just of a piece. Of course there would be outlets online, whether it was individual blogs or Pitchfork, that would rise up to cover this new phase of the industry. Ben Blackwell. At that Radio City show, I remember thinking that the three new songs the Strokes played were so good, and I pretty quickly got a recording of that show. I think it might have even come from that girl, Laura Young, who ran that Modern Age blog. Imran Ahmed. As new bands editor at NME, I was very aware of the New York music bloggers. I used to look at the Modern Age blog every day.
Laura Young. I was working at InStyle as an intern, and they had a freebie table. I was in the research department, and I remember somebody coming over, and they were like, "Oh, hey, you like music, right? I found this CD." And it was Is This It with the UK cover and New York City Cops on it. I remember seeing it and flipping out. I went home and listened to it, and that was pretty much it.
Ben Blackwell. Laura was very instrumental. When the White Stripes played Letterman, and we walked out the back door, she was there. She was always writing about whatever we did, both the White Stripes and the Strokes.
Laura Young. With Napster, there was a lot of free music around, or music that you could get for no money very easily. And being in New York, you have some of the best concert venues at your fingertips, and thousands of bands coming through here trying to get press, so it just worked.
Jason Gordon. Laura was the first one that I got acquainted with that had a blog about music. It wasn't like her blog was anything exceptional. It was just wonderful that here was this blog about a girl who is obsessed with two bands that are amazing, the White Stripes and the Strokes, both of whom were still playing at Mercury Lounge at that time. And I was at those shows. It was like, these are my people. Imran Ahmed. Laura's blog, which was named after the Strokes song, obviously, was probably the most important because Laura was obsessed with the White Stripes and the Strokes. She was like the New York arm of what we were doing in the UK. But because she was much more in the thick of it, she would go out and take photos of the White Stripes and the Strokes doing stuff in New York, and it seemed really relevant.
Sarah Lewitton. Back then, there were no cameras. I had a digital camera, but you had to host photos on Flickr or something. When you managed to post photos online, it felt like a really big deal.
Scott Lapatine. This was way later, and obviously Arcade Fire are not a New York band, but it sort of represented that era. I saw them play at Mercury Lounge at CMJ in 2004, and I was in the front and taking photos on a cheap camera and putting them on stereo gum. And NME was like, we want to run your photos in a big two-page spread. I was like, seriously? And you'll pay me? If you had a camera, you were in the game. Imran Ahmed. I also used to look at Sarah Lewitton's Sarah's So Boring Ever Since She Stopped Drinking blog every day.
Sarah Lewitton. I started blogging a little later than Laura. We had a 4th of July party on the roof of our apartment on Rivington Street, and it was craziness. I was shit-faced trying to clean up, and I ended up cutting myself. Multiple people saw me freak about the mess, clean up, cut myself, ignore the cut to finish cleaning, and I think they were like, she has had so much to drink that she can't even feel her cut. It was a gash, really. So my brothers confronted me. I stopped drinking, but they would still call me every day and every night to check up on me. I decided to make the blog so they would stop calling me every day.
Michael Hirshhorn. Sarah was kind of mascot. She was this, like, teenage virgin, Sabbath-observing party girl. She was highly fetishized.
Sarah Lewitton. By the way, I started drinking again less than a month later.
Mark Spitz. Ultra Girl was my discovery. I was recently hired at Spin Online. We were still part of AOL. And she instant messaged me. This is like back when I didn't even know what the fucking instant message was. It was just like, what is this box appearing on my screen? She said, I really like what you're writing. You should give me a job. And I said, why? And she's like, because I'm Ultra. And I said, what the fuck is an Ultra? She came in and she looked like an alien, with a man's sort of bleach blonde yellow Tweety Bird quiff. And she had no eyebrows. She'd bleached and plucked them.
Sarah Lewitton. I remember telling Mark they were evil, they had to go.
Mark Spitz. She was this anime, like, Eon Flux person. I told Ron Richardson, my boss at the time, I said, hey, you've been talking about how we need an intern. It was like a puppy. Can we keep her? Can we keep her? Alan Light was editor-in-chief, and Sarah and I would go to Alan, who wore button-down shirts and trousers, and we'd sort of prance around him in our feather boas and leather jackets and hope he'd notice us, and I don't know, make us stars. Meanwhile, the guy is trying to keep the magazine from going under in a world where Creed are selling 10 million records. We were hipster mosquitoes up in his shit going, spin, spin, party! Sarah was my partner in stirring shit up. Andy Greenwald. I love Alan, but he didn't give a shit about spin.com. Alan Light. I felt like it was bulletin boards, and it was chats, and it was fun. Online was a good excuse to have those kids around and give them something to do and sort of develop them a little bit, and develop some of this kind of coverage. But I don't remember having any sense of who was reading this.
Sarah Lewitton. In the early days, blogging was fun because it was just so stupid and raw and bizarre and human. I was working at Spin at the time, but no one at Spin thought anyone was reading my blog. I didn't think anyone was reading my blog. You didn't have trackers to mark the traffic you were getting.
John Heilman. People would say to you, this is bullshit. It will die. It is unsustainable. It will go away. This is not the future.
Tracy Pepper. They were downstairs, and the magazine's staff were upstairs. It was dark where the online team worked, and there were no windows. Truthfully, I didn't pay that much attention to online. None of us did. I have a vague memory of being asked for interview outtakes that they could use online and my grumbling about it. It was just extra work for us.
Andy Greenwald. We were so left alone and ignored. We had such autonomy. We were running our own reviews of records. We had a full-time video person who did all of these incredibly cool features. Chris Ryan doing karaoke with Cat Power all night. Crazy shit like that. We had every band that's big now come into our office and play acoustic on video. But no one had broadband except for college campuses, so no one could watch it. We had Death Cab for Cutie and Spoon and Interpol, and all these bands come in and sit on our couch and no one cared. No one in the office cared. No one even noticed.
Sarah Lewitton. I knew about Interpol way before they signed to Matador. I had a copy of their demos. I played it for my friends at Spin, and they liked it too. We would go see their shows. It would be me, friends from Spin, and the girlfriends. Paul's girlfriend, Daniel's girlfriend, Sam's girlfriend, and the seven girls that banged Carlos that week.
Daniel Kessler. I don't know what position Sarah had at Spin way back in the day, but they took her seriously. She was a teenager, but she was really passionate, and she had their ear. We went in, and we did a Spin web session. It was in their conference room. It was the days of, we'll take anything you give us. Andy Greenwald. This was around when Pitchfork launched, by the way. So later they were doing everything that we were doing first. John Heilman. There was the world of mainstream publishing in New York City, which had not really accepted the idea that the internet was here to stay. The idea that it would even be a co-equal element of their publishing model, let alone the idea that it would be dominant, no one thought that. No one thought that, and anyone that claims they thought that is full of shit. Ryan Schreiber. There was still that fear that if they published everything online, who would buy the magazine? The print publications were extremely guarded about the internet, wary of it, and their lateness allowed us, allowed Pitchfork, to establish ourselves as the authority, because there was no other existing authority on the internet. Imran Ahmed. Another one, maybe a little later, was Stereo Gum. I looked at Stereo Gum every day. Scott Lapatine. I bought StereoGum.com in 2003. The name comes from a song lyric from the band Air. Imran Ahmed. And there was one other one. Product Shop NYC. Jason Gordon. When I was really young, growing up on Long Island, I had a print zine that I made in my house called American Mod. It was an awful name. So we changed it to Product Shop NYC. I was just a fan of music, and I started interviewing bands like The Makeup, Jonathan Fire Eater, Blonde Redhead, D-Generation, and Weezer. After college, I came back to New York. I decided to leave the music industry, because in college I discovered this website Napster and thought, I'm not going to work in this industry that's going to die. I'm going to go into book publishing. Ugh. But I was friends with all these people in the music industry in, like, the 90s and early, like, 2000s. And I was going out to shows all the time and meeting all these bands. I was at shows, like, 5 days a week in 2001. Rob Sheffield. The collapse of Britpop has a lot to do with this. The people who were interested in these bands in the early 2000s ordinarily would have been interested in bands from London. And the sort of cultural turf that the New York bands operated was turf that had been abandoned by Britpop. Suddenly there weren't London kids in skinny pants and leather jackets anymore. So people all over the world who looked to that, they found it in New York. I mean, it's funny. When the Strokes started and people said, the Ramones, Television. They don't sound like those bands at all. They sound like Elastica.
Audrey Melody Nelson. In college, I discovered a deep love for music, especially indie and Britpop. When I moved to New York, I started going to a few shows, mostly British bands passing through, and I became an avid NME, Uncut, Mojo reader. I was going to Rebel Rebel, Other Music, and Tower Records on a weekly basis to buy imports before they were released in the U.S. Interpol was my band. When I first saw them, I immediately connected with the Joy Division references. By the late 90s, I was obsessed with message boards. When I had to choose a name for those forums, I picked Melody Nelson as my handle, since I had been a big Serge Gainsbourg fan for years. All my friends in New York were big music fans, and I started going to more and more shows. A lot of them were interested in knowing what I had to say about the shows and bands. I launched my blog in the fall of 2002.
Rob Sheffield. Audrey's blog, which was indeed called Melody Nelson, plus The Modern Age and Sarah's So Boring, a few other more short-lived ones like New York Doll, really erased the barriers between fan and reporter. In the 90s, they would have been fanzines, but these blogs were accessible all over the world instantly, which meant they were influential. Very girl-dominated, which wasn't necessarily the case with 80s or 90s fanzine culture.
Saya Michael. I remember reading Stereogum and The Modern Age, which Sarah introduced me to, and of course I read her blog too. What I really liked about the early blog era is that young women who might not have felt like they were welcome in the still very male-dominated rock critic world were finding a voice and a new way to cover the scene. There was something about it that reminded me a little bit of the Riot Girl zine era. These bloggers were an interesting mix of fan, reporter, cool hunter, and authority. Now everyone has a social media megaphone, but at the time it seemed so striking that anyone could weigh in about music. I also really liked Flux Blog and the MP3 blogs that followed. I remember how exciting it was to sit there and so easily listen to the exact tracks you were reading about.
Rob Sheffield. There were boys doing them too, like Jason Gordon, but it seemed like it was the girls who were tastemakers. NME in this period was basically a weekly UK magazine reporting on what was in NYC rock girl blogs last week. Mark Spitz. This was an era when the NME was calling the people in these bands as if they were part of a gang. Like Julian wasn't Julian Casablancas, he was Julian Strokes. It wasn't Paul Banks, it was Paul Interpol. Like a sort of tabloidization of the scene, which actually had the effect of making everyone closer. The bloggers were the same in a micro way. On the scene in New York, it wasn't Jason Gordon, it was Jason Product Shop. Like his last name was his blog. Melody Nelson wasn't that blogger's name. It was a Serge Gainsbourg fictional character that was her calling card. That's what you called her. Laura Modern Age, or Miss Modern Age. Nobody called her by her last name. I still don't know how to spell Ultra Girl's last name. I think it's with two N's. Rob Sheffield. I remember when Yeah Yeah Yeahs were on the cover of The Face, and in the story there was a photo Nick Zinner took on stage with Karen rocking out at Bowery Ballroom. And the photo cracked me up because you could see all these faces in the front row who were NYC rock girl bloggers. Audrey from Melody Nelson, Laura from The Modern Age, etc. Jason Gordon. You didn't feel like anyone was even reading it, except for like your 10 friends.
Tracy Pepper. I have no memory of reading any blogs except Sarah's, and I definitely didn't see them as a threat. I was very snobby about journalism. I wasn't interested in reading the special thoughts of people who fancied themselves writers.
Rob Sheffield. The bloggers weren't really critics, as far as I could tell. They weren't interested in arguing about why you should or shouldn't agree with them. They only had time for the bands they liked. If they didn't like a band, they just didn't write about them. But there was absolutely no way to bullshit these girls. They had zero incentive to pretend to like a band they didn't like. Also, iPods had just been invented, so almost all these girls were part-time DJs, which was now suddenly an incredibly easy job that required zero technical skills or record-collecting tendencies. John Heilman. The mainstream magazine publishing world did not really capitulate to the fact that the web was here to stay until 2001, 2002, when it didn't go away. When the web didn't collapse along with the tech bubble. The tech bubble collapsed and everyone exhaled, and then it didn't go away. And web traffic kept going, and people were like, wait, huh?
Laura Young. When did I realize something was shifting? A year or two after I started. I had already graduated college, so I was working some internship right out of school. There was a moment in, like, 2002 or 2003 where I was just someone writing, and then these other people are commenting on it, which was kind of strange. Sarah Lewitton. I first realized people were paying attention, like, for real, when they started trash-talking me online.
Scott Lapatine. I went on my honeymoon. I was going to have to take a break from blogging, and at that point I couldn't just shut it down for 2 weeks. I had a college friend take over. It was like, hey Jim, here's the password. Maybe you can keep it updated while I'm away? And when I got back, he had leaked half of the Strokes album, Room on Fire. Suddenly I'm dealing with all these legal complaints. Jason Gordon. All of a sudden I started getting emails to me saying you should come to this show. It was not even hard.
Laura Young. It was weird to me that people in marketing or people involved with actual bands were contacting me and offering me tickets. It was like, stop trying to ruin my fun by getting all businessy on me.
Rob Sheffield. By the middle of 2003, bands like The Strokes and The Stripes and Interpol would be playing bigger sold-out shows that were harder to get into. But the girl bloggers were already on the trail of The Stills or Franz Ferdinand or The Go Team or whoever. All of us at every level of musical journalism were paying attention to what they had to say.
Sarah Lewitton. Eventually, I got hired full-time by Spin. Zaya hired me. I remember she called and offered me something, and I just said, okay, and she was like, you're supposed to negotiate.
Mark Spitz. What Alan politely tolerated was exactly what Sia, his successor, responded to. She did make us stars. In that world, anyway. She wanted these rock and roll people in the office. A couple of them, at least.
Tracy Pepper. Sarah was blogging about partying with up-and-coming bands like The Killers and The Vines. She'd come into my office all the time and tell me about some band that was about to blow up, and she was nearly always right.
Mark Spitz. She was just picking these bands one after another. She would be chattering about Interpol, and then you'd hear they signed to Matador. She'd be chatting about My Chemical Romance, and then you'd hear that they signed to Warner Bros. She would be chatting about Muse, and then they broke. She would be chatting about The Killers, and then she actually helped them get signed.
Sarah Lewitton. I had started my own label, Stolen Transmission, out of my apartment. That actually was thanks to this guy, Rob Stevenson, who was in A&R at Island Def Jam. I met him when I was balancing a wine glass on my head at the label's holiday party back in 2001, and he hired me to scout for him. I was managing My Chemical Romance at the time, and telling him about Interpol and The Strokes, and he was like, you should do a singles label and sell them on your blog. So I did that with a bunch of bands. They sold out like hotcakes. Then I got a book deal and a record label offer, so I quit Spin. Rob asked me to come over to Island Def Jam to help him, and he offered to help me with Stolen Transmission. Stolen Transmission became an official partnership between Rob and me.
Jason Gordon. I was a 24-year-old kid going to my day job in book publishing, and then moonlighting. I was getting credentials to cover the 2004 Democratic Convention, where I was the publicist for Barack Obama, who was a state senator at the time. I was hanging out with him before he gave his keynote speech. I would be secretly finding time in between moments like that to post on Product Shop. It was like an alternate life. It was ridiculous. Scott Lapatine. I was working at VH1, and for a while it was definitely like having two full-time jobs. It was work. I had a lot of flexibility, so if I was working on a post for an hour or two during the day, I would just stay late at the office. I was often at the office until 2 a.m. or whatever. But I was getting some feedback like, hey, some venture capitalists might invest and turn this into a business. And I had already been selling adverting, which was just an easy thing. So at a certain point, money was coming in from Stereo Gum, and I was frustrated at work. So I just quit. Ryan Schreber. I recruited a lot of bloggers to write for Pitchfork. I felt very much like the bloggers were my peers. They were doing what they did for the same reasons that I was doing what I was doing, which was just love of, passion for this music and this culture. I felt a kinship with them.
Laura Young. At the time, I remember the internet was whatever. I was really focused on, I want to work in print. I want to be a print journalist. Like, that means that you're the real deal. But at some point, I was like, wait, I like this internet thing.
Chapter 49. Rock is back? Julian Casablancas. The Vines, the Hives, and White Stripes, and Us. I think those four bands were the initial vibe. Pelle Almqvist. I realized something very important. A musical movement is a style of pants. Think about it. San Francisco, 1967. You know what pants that is. New York, 1977. You know what pants that is. Disco? You know the pants? There were baggy pants and ripped jeans in the 90s. Nirvana had them, Soundgarden had them, and Stone Temple Pilots, Pearl Jam, they all had the same pants. They don't really sound that much alike, but they had the same pants, so obviously it's a musical movement. Then there was Limp Bizkit and Linkin Park, they had the same pants. It was obviously a musical movement. And then we had the Strokes, the White Stripes, and Us with tight pants. It's a musical movement. For the record, our pants came from a company called Tiger of Sweden. They're good pants. Matt Pinfield. I remember when I first saw the Hives play, it was like, who the fuck are these kids? Harmar Superstar. It's totally weird rock and roll circus theater. Jack White. The first time we met the Hives was on Top of the Pops in London. We hadn't been introduced yet. But while we performed our song on the stage across from them, the Hives all stood in a row on their stage with their hands behind their backs, motionless. I loved them so much for that. Still one of my favorite things I've ever seen in my life. It wasn't approval or politeness or a battle of the band's competition move or anything. Or maybe it was all of that. Or maybe they were just trying to make us laugh, which they did. Gorgeous idea. Pelle Almqvist. A lot of what we've done is trying to set an example for other bands to do, and then they can do it instead of us. But no one ever really takes the torch, so we still have to run with it. Jack White. Howlin' Pelle is incredibly funny, one of the funniest people I've ever met. Pelle Almqvist. That whole garage rock revolution happened in Sweden earlier, in the late 90s. By 2000, there was a bunch of Scandinavian garage rock bands making their way in Europe. But we always felt like we were our own thing. We put out our first record in 97. We did a bunch of touring in 98. Put out some records, and then, in 2000, we put out Vene Vidi Vicious, which was what made it happen for us. Mark Spitz. The Hives had cred coming in because Alan McGee, fresh off Oasis success, signed them to Pop Tones. Isaac Green. Alan McGee had started Creation Records and had some of the biggest bands ever in England, including Oasis, disappeared, closed Creation, and then started the Pop Tones label, which was very millennial, almost dot-com-ish. Mark Spitz. They eventually signed to Universal for some ridiculous amount of money. But they had respect out of the gate because of the UK Cool Hunter thing. Connor McNicholas. After the Strokes, the record labels saw the shift, so you had this weird international garage rock culture emerge, where you had the Hives from Sweden, you had the Vines from Australia, you had the whole Detroit thing. We were desperate, fucking desperate for anybody who could play guitar. So many of those bands were shit, but we just needed stuff to fill the pages. And the kids needed something to get excited about.
Sarah Lewitton. The Vines all met because they were working at the same McDonald's down in Sydney, I think. Which is funny because all Craig, the singer, ever ate was McDonald's. Kind of makes you think they were destined to be famous in America, right?
Mark Spitz. The Vines were just goofy kids. Steve Schiltz. Nobody knew at the time that Craig had Asperger's. He just seemed batshit crazy. Patrick Matthews. Craig was very quiet, but he was also very funny. We were friends because he was funny and he liked music. But I think the whole nutcase thing definitely comes from smoking pot. because he didn't really have a temper until pot came into his life. Pele Almqvist. We had nothing to do with anything contemporary in rock and roll at the time. We thought our success would come in punk rock clubs all over Europe. But that would be pretty much it. The aim was to make a record that we were really proud of. No one would buy it, and then we would get jobs. Patrick Matthews. We had really ambitious managers. Nothing probably would have happened if it hadn't been for those managers. Matt Pinfield. People wanted the 3 or 4 minute punk rock songs. That's the great thing about garage rock. And because of the Strokes, all these bands also knew then that they could start a career overseas and bring it back. Not since the Ramones and Blondie had that been a factor. These bands knew you could get really big overseas. Pele Almqvist. I was so happy when that first Strokes EP came out that I emailed them. Hey, I'm in a band too. Love it, love it, love it. Then we did a European tour with a bunch of other bands. 22 people in a tour bus, super illegal. And the first show was at a club called Molotov in Hamburg, Germany. It's a room that fits maybe 200 people. And there was a line of like 6,700 people outside. We sold all the t-shirts we had brought for our entire European tour that day. That's when we realized that, you know, this might actually work. The world was starting to make sense. Patrick Matthews. We recorded Highly Evolved from July 2001 to Christmas Eve in L.A. We were signed to Capitol, and it was all organized for us, so it wasn't so difficult. Someone just said, you're going to record here with this guy. And we were like, cool, he recorded Beck. And then you're going to stay in this hotel, and it's all taken care of. It all came down to our managers. Someone else was skillfully manipulating the press for us, getting a lot of stuff in NME, and getting us this buzz band reputation. We were just playing. We went to England, played a couple tiny places with the Libertines. We did a promo tour in America. Steve Schiltz, one of their many managers, saw Longway that gig on the green, and he liked the band. We did one tour with them. It was in Europe, and I remember we had a bus. One of the few times we had a bus, and that was exciting. Immediately Patrick was the guy we talked to. I remember being in some city, just sitting in a dressing room talking to Patrick about how he had to make a decision about going back to med school or not. Craig just seemed batshit crazy. And Hamish, the drummer, was very sweet and very, like, hired gun. He gave our drummer a copy of Modern Drummer magazine, like, hey, I'm done with this if you want to check it out. And our drummer was like, pfft. I mean, not to be a dick, but we're like, what? And then like, no, man. We found out he had been in some, like, Beatles tribute band before that. He was like Topper Hedden from The Clash. When Topper Hedden joined The Clash, all of a sudden he started wearing letter jackets and the sailor's cap. He had, you know, an identikit. Matt Pinfield. The Vines obviously had a Nirvana kind of thing that did very well. I liked part of that record. I loved the title track, Highly Evolved. I just didn't know if I thought the guy was legit. You know what I mean? But I love those songs. Imran Ahmed. The Vines felt quite on the fence of whether they were actually any good or not. I thought Craig Nichols was such an intriguing character, but there wasn't much depth coming from him. He was pulling silly faces in NME every week. In hindsight, with him being diagnosed with Asperger's, it all makes a bit more sense. At the time, it just felt odd. He clearly wasn't well. Mark Spitz. I did the Vines' first piece for Spin. I was backstage at Letterman with the band and their friends and people from their label and publicity team. The band and I were in a locked room for most of the time before the performance, just filling the room with a wall of weed smoke. I was taking notes and studying Craig, and he was really stoned and calm, almost catatonic. And then they go out, and Letterman was like, hey, they are kids. They play Get Free, and by the middle of the song it sounds nothing like the single, and Craig is just braying like a donkey. And then they finish the song and he knocks over the cymbal stand with his guitar neck and throws the guitar at the drummer. The drummer throws up his sticks like, fuck this, and Craig runs onto the set and flings himself into the guest chair, then gets back on the mic and starts screaming. Letterman called them troubled teens and asked Paul Schaefer if Craig was all right. Patrick Matthews. Someone asked Craig about the Letterman performance, and he goes, "Well, the buildings seemed really big in New York, and I was a little bit homesick." And that was his explanation for it.
Sarah Lewitton. Yeah, and later that night, Craig was jumping in trash cans and pouring water on his head and running down the empty streets of the Lower East Side shouting.
Imran Ahmed. But the songs were brilliant, and they stand up. If it hadn't been for the Vines, there wouldn't be an Arctic Monkeys. They've gone on the record in the past and said, "One of the reasons we formed the band was because of the Vines." If you were 21, the Vines are just great. The Vines played their role. They were important. They were fun. They were like trashy. It was an intriguing story. All the other bands talked about them. Mark Spitz. The Hives would have seemed like the more high concept of the two, but they were actually much less manufactured. The Hives were punk rock kids from Stockholm, who had this atypical sophistication and beauty. The arrogance is a put-on. The rock scene in Stockholm is like this Nick Hornby wet dream. Everyone is sensitive, and a record collector, and drop-dead beautiful. The Hives knew B-sides. They knew Peel sessions. They were really formal, even when they were out eating and drinking, very studied and polite. And live, Pele and Nicholas, if you watch them, are basically controlling the crowd like DJs. They're more like a Kraftwerk type of band than a Stooges type of band. It's puzzling that they're pretty much the best live band I've ever seen, because even though they're sweating, they're computing. Patrick Matthews. At the MTV Video Music Awards that year, when they did the Battle of the Bands, we shared a dressing room. And the singer for the Hives is quite haughty. He sort of strutted around. Pele Almqvist. I know other bands turned it down. I wish they asked us first. You get a feeling that the White Stripes would have said no, but we felt ruthless enough to just say fuck it. Patrick Matthews. That was another thing organized on the record company level, and it was just ridiculous. The Hives were on the jutted out stage right, and we had the entire main stage, where mine and Craig's amps were 20 meters apart. And then they had, like, you could ring up and vote or something. Ugh. Pele Almqvist. The VMAs felt kind of corny, but we got to meet J-Lo. Patrick Matthews. The gift bags were great. I remember that they had a PlayStation, some hair gel, and like 25 different kinds of cocktail salt.
Jenny Eliscu. At the time, I remember not really caring for the Vines. I liked the Hives, but I just thought, like, now everyone's a Strokes. Is that what's going to be happening now?
Ryan Adams. The Strokes were going to maybe be on the cover of Rolling Stone. It was going to be them or the Vines. And they did the Vines. As a fan of those guys and as a friend, but mostly just as a Strokes fan, I remember thinking what a travesty that was. That was just a huge mistake. Patrick Matthews. I remember getting phone calls from someone at Capitol to organize the photo shoot for the Rolling Stone cover, and I remember saying to her, "I know you're joking, but I'll turn up to this photo shoot." She kept going, "No, no, no, we've got the cover." It was like I was being tricked. Mark Spitz. The cover line just read, "Rock is back." Rob Sheffield. Yeah, I wrote that story. That's still a little traumatic. I was just sitting in a room with this dude from the Vines doing bong hits constantly, and literally the only topic that would get him going was talking about the Strokes and the White Stripes. Patrick Matthews. Rob had a really calming influence on Craig. Mark Spitz. The cover of Rolling Stone was still a big deal. It always is. They are sometimes late to the party, but there's still no greater confirmation that you are in the center of culture at that moment. So seeing the Vines on the cover over the Strokes or the White Stripes was a little strange. It was kind of like the fourth band in the queue cut to the front of the line when nobody was looking. and the Strokes, etc., were reduced to width, like they were guest stars on a sitcom called Rock Is Back, starring the Vines, with a special appearance by Jack White as the caretaker. Rob Sheffield. This was a cover shoot where we had to airbrush eyeballs into Craig Nichols's eyelids because he was incapable of opening them at the photo shoot. So the cover is the other three members of the Vines holding him upright while he makes a dazed expression. Rock Is Back? Yes, it was. Chapter 50. Taking all our Britpop tricks and selling them back to us. Connor McNicholas. The Strokes is arriving opened the door for the White Stripes, and as soon as that shift happened, there was this massive demand for bands from anywhere we could get them. But there were no British bands to fulfill it, because nobody there had picked up a guitar in like 10, 15 years. Everyone in England sold all their guitars and bought decks, and sold all their decks and bought keyboards. Until that key moment when Emran Ahmed turned up in the office with a CD and said, "This band is called Franz Ferdinand." And everyone went, "That's a really good name." He said, "They have this song, and it has the lyric, 'Words are poison darts of pleasure.'" And you could feel the whole office just go, click. We love lyrics. It was the first time a British band had written a lyric that anybody gave a shit about since Blur's Park Life. Imran Ahmed. I'd been at NME for a year, and I was keen to put my stamp on things. I'd arrived just after the first wave of excitement of the Strokes and the White Stripes. My experience of these bands, who I'd written about, was that American acts would often only be around for a few weeks at a time. As new bands editor at NME, I was very strongly on the lookout for a British band in the great history of the Smiths or the Stone Roses. Someone who seemed as fresh as those guys. Rob Sheffield. When Franz Ferdinand came out with their first single, Darts of Pleasure, at the end of 2003, it was really comical at first to see what was going on. Here's a Glasgow band who are clearly inspired by the Strokes and the White Stripes, and what's happening in New York City, and what blog girls are dancing to at Don Hills. They're trying to capture that skinny tie, drainpipe trousers, mod beat aesthetic, and sell it back to New York City. Just like the Beatles did when they sold Chuck Berry-inspired rock and roll back to America 40 years earlier. Imran Ahmed. Franz had been subject to a real bidding war. I believe Lawrence at Domino remortgaged his house in order to sign them. Lawrence Bell. They were just so good that there was no way that people wouldn't like them. To what extent, I really didn't have any idea. I thought, oh, they'll be like somewhere between, on the popularity scale, somewhere between Pavement and the Strokes. I thought we'd sell, you know, up to a 500,000 records. We ended up selling 4 million records on the first album. Imran Ahmed. Everyone at NME loved Franz from when they first heard them. They appealed to some real core NME values. Art school kids, well-read, into great music. Clearly Orange Juice and Talking Heads. I definitely pushed to get them on the NME tour, and to have the Vines kicked off so Franz would get their first cover. Alex Kapranos. I'd had a key realization a few years before. I'd been in a band called the Corellia, and we'd been signed to a heavy metal label. We were doing this vaguely foppish indie music coming from Glasgow, and it just really didn't work. We got dropped. So, at 26, 27, I was like, okay, so this is it. I'm not going to have a career in music. That's fine. Also, it was the ass end of Britpop. And in Britain, everyone seemed to be listening to electronic music or something vaguely acoustic, like Coldplay. So I thought, ah well, I'm still gonna play in bands, but I'm gonna have to work in bars. That was an important realization. Because it meant that I was doing all the stuff with Franz Ferdinand with absolutely no idea, in my head or anybody else's, that we were going to do this to make money to pay our rent. Tunde Edebimpe. Failure is the best. After you fail, you're free. Alex Kapranos. Music was all very social. It was an excuse to socialize and go out for a drink. That's how our band started. We just hung out with each other. and we'd go to parties together in Glasgow. Bob, our bass player, didn't play an instrument when we got the band together. I got a bass from Mick Cook from Bell and Sebastian, because we were in another band together. In fact, the band started off over an argument we were having, over a bottle of whiskey. My argument was that anybody that likes music can be a musician. Whether they'll be a good musician is a different story. But so I said, come on, I'll show you how to play the bass. It's really not that hard. Jaleel Bunton. This entire story is based on kids around the world being like, oh, I can do that now? You don't have to be able to play scales and put intricate things together. You can just mean it. Alex Kapranos. What you like is as much a part of your makeup as what you don't like. And at that time, around 1999 to 2001, there was a wave of artists who were performing just with laptops. Your whole weekend was spent watching some guy move a mouse around. That just epitomized everything I hated about live performance. This music that was technically quite revolutionary was fucking boring. Maybe not boring to listen to in certain circumstances, but as a performance, it was fucking awful. There was a lack of humanity, rawness, a lack of sweat and stink. There wasn't anything powerful about it. For us, there was a rebellion against that programming side of things. We used synthesizers, but we used crappy old Italian synths that we picked up at second-hand shops that you had to play by hand. We wanted to play it rather than program it.
Justine D. I love Franz Ferdinand because they have this kind of retro, very gracious rock and roll type performer thing. They have a level of showmanship that a lot of new bands don't have. They think that they can just stand up there. It's different if you're My Bloody Valentine or a shoegaze band, kind of mopey. That's its own thing. But otherwise, put on a show. I'm here to be entertained, you know? And Franz Ferdinand did that.
Alex Kapranos. There was also a distinct club scene that was going on in Glasgow at that time, too. I was immersed in that. There were a couple of places, but particularly this one club called Optimo. Luke Jenner. Scotland weirdly had a dance music history. Soma put out the first Daft Punk record, and that's a Scottish label. They just really get it, for whatever reason. Alex Kapranos. House of Jealous Lovers by The Rapture had a big impact on that club in particular. Connor McNicholas. You Americans, at the time, had never been taken over by dance music and ecstasy culture quite the way we were. But over here, post-Britpop, it so completely ate popular culture. Music was just dance music, nothing else. Nothing else could really get a look in. It was the totality of being 16 to 25. It's just what you did. Alex Kapranos. House of Jealous Lovers, that was first. Then Losing My Edge. When that came out, it also had a massive impact. And Optimo definitely would have been the first place I heard it. Vito Roccaforte. When we first toured England, we played Optimo. We'd played this weird hardcore festival in northern Belgium, which was horrible, just muddy, and we didn't belong there. Then drove overnight into Sunday to play Glasgow at Optimo. We didn't know what it was. We're like, this is gonna suck. It's a Sunday. We were all like, dude, this club's fucking amazing. The show ended at 2, and we went to an after party until like noon the next day. I made friends that I still have to this day. Luke Jenner. They party for 4 days in a row in Scotland. By day 3, they don't have their shoes, they stink. They're like on some fucking insane cocktail of drugs and drinking, and it's just like, go to sleep, dude. And they're like, no way, mate. Vito Roccaforte. James Murphy was doing sound for us on that tour, so he was hanging out. Phil Mossman. Everything with LCD started off on the dance scene. Our early shows were at clubs like Optimo. The UK was kind of clammy leading up to that. It was all like Manic Street Preachers and The Skinny Boy and Primal Scream, Stone Roses. Big Cheekbones, Attitude, Oasis. Attitude or a moody DJ. No one was cheery. No one was approachable. So LCD was different. It would be on our club night when everyone was eat up, and there'd be a DJ, and then there'd be this band. Alex Kapranos. James is funny. I remember seeing them play in Glasgow, and somebody in the front row had thrown a glass of water over him, which was probably